Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Now, discretion is once again advised for our listeners, as this conversation may be distressing for some people. Last week, 23-year-old Cameron Cooper of Ballyneety Road in Ballyfermot in Dublin was jailed for 4 years and 3 months for causing the death of 21-year-old Dylan Killaly Marr. Cooper pleaded guilty to dangerous driving causing death, driving with no insurance, making a false report of a crime and failing to offer assistance after the crash, which happened in November 2023. Dylan's mother, Catherine Killaly, gave an incredible plea, an impassioned plea outside the court for reform in the sentencing of these cases. And Catherine is with me in studio. Thanks for being here, first of all, Catherine.
Thank you, Oliver, for having me.
I've read your victim impact statement. It's 8-9 pages long.
Yeah.
And you give us this story of this, who exactly your lovely, decent son Dylan was. Do you mind sharing that with us, please? Because as a child, he was a very happy kid with loads of friends.
He was indeed. He was very happy. He kept us on our toes, you know.
Did
he was he was full of life, full of energy. He wanted to be part of everything. You know, he was out playing on the road. He had loads of friends. He was in football clubs. He played hurling. He played soccer. He played GAA. He was into everything. He was just a really outdoor, a typical young boy, into everything.
Everybody in Coolock.
We also lived in Kilbarrick for 10 years as well.
Did you?
And then we moved back to Coolock, where we're originally from.
Found friends everywhere he went.
Everywhere. And everyone remembered him because Dylan was, he was a funny character. He could be a bit of a messer, but not in a, you know, a bad way or anything, funny way. He always made a funny situation out of, you know, if someone was sad or, you know, something happened, it's you know, it'd break the ice and, you know, it's...
Is that right?
Yeah.
On dark days, you'd want him around you.
Exactly. You'd want him around you.
In your victim impact statement, you said he had a character, a personality a bit like yourself.
Like myself, yeah. Yes, he did indeed. And his granddad, you know.
The messers,
the jokers, you know. We used to be great banter in the house, and we're in his grandparents' house as well, you know. And that banter is just, you know, it's not the same. There is banter, but it's just not the same anymore.
Of course, you know? Yeah. Sports mad and being football mad is particularly important for his relationship with his dad, Paul.
Yeah.
Very close.
Very close, yeah. They were very close bonds. Very close.
Man United fans.
My youngest son, Darren, and his father, Paul, is going to Manchester on Sunday.
It holds the family together in
bad
times.
It holds the family together. They're all United fans in the house. So they're going on Sunday. It was a Christmas gift for them.
Dylan, he was one of three, four children. He's the second.
He was the second born.
He's the second. Child. And tell us about the rest of your family then.
My eldest son, Evan, he's 26. Great kid as well. Great kid growing up. They were actually like chalk and cheese, you know.
Right?
Evan was, you know, he was real quiet and, you know,
reserved.
Yeah, the serious one. You know, I used to say with Dylan, you know, second child syndrome, you know, and your middle child. And, you know, Dylan, as I said, he was full of life, full of energy. He wanted to be part of everything. And Evan, he was the more timid one, quiet one, you know. And, you know, it was even mentioned, you know, in parent teacher meetings, God, they're like chalk and cheese, aren't they? You know, yeah. But like, as I said, Dylan, he was never, you know, harmful or anything. It was just funny, you know. He was really, he had a great sense. It was the person you'd always remember. And I remember when Dylan passed, I was reading the condolences on the RIP, and actually a teacher from his junior school,
right,
actually still remembered him back then in there, Lady Immaculate. You know, she wrote a lovely piece about Dylan, how she remembered him and all. And that's how far back, you know, of all the children that teacher taught, you know, she remembered Dylan.
When does someone in your level of grief and pain get to read those messages? Because they're very important.
It was a good few months.
Months later.
Yeah.
And there are younger kids as well in the family.
Yeah, there is the twins, Kayla and Dara. They were 14 when Dylan was killed. They're now 16.
My God.
Yeah.
Very tough on them as well.
Very tough.
You had great relationship with Dylan, chatting to him. You advise him on doing things in life. He wanted to leave school at one stage.
He did. He wanted to leave school in fifth year. So I said, no way, you're not leaving school. You're finishing school. I said, you're sixth year. He just wanted to go out, get a job, earn his own few bob, and, you know. And I said, no, I said, you need to finish school. So during the summer holidays, after, you know, fifth year finished, he was like, Mom, I'm actually bored. I can't wait to go back to school. I can't wait to start sixth year and go back to school.
He listened to his mom.
He listened when Mammy said something, they listened, you know. So he was delighted that he did stick out school, and he got a great leaving cert results, and he went straight in. Dylan was very young starting school. Dylan was born in May, so which he started school into September, so he would have been 4 in May. So he actually finished his junior cert his leaving cert when he was 17. So he was 17 in the May, finished his leaving cert into June, and he was straight into a job.
He was impatient for life to happen.
He just wanted to get out there and start working.
And an electrician, that's what
electrician,
he wanted to do.
Yeah,
good job.
Yeah.
He was doing a course in Kerry at the time.
He was doing his college in Kerry, yeah.
Very close to finishing it.
Very 6 weeks. He had 6 weeks left.
He was only 6 weeks.
He was killed in November, and January he was to start his final 6 weeks of his electrician.
Again, just to portray to people what this kid was like, worked extremely hard, never off sick or anything. Give you a few bob as well from
his wage. He handed it. And that was, you know, we were reared that way. You know, I'm one of six siblings. I'm the second youngest, the youngest girl. And that's the way we were raised. It's a teaching for them in life. You don't get everything handed to you. Eventually, your children are going to fly the nest, and do you have to go and pay bills and, you know, look after themselves? And so this is a teaching that you have to teach your kids.
He was a very caring young fella as well, close to his grandparents, which would be rare enough.
His grandparents, as we said, we lived in Kilbarrick for 10 years. Kilbarrick is not too far from the Coolock area. I got an opportunity to move to up beside my mother and father, and I worked in the Coolock area. I was a childcare worker for over 15 years.
And he was taking care of, was it your mum?
My mother. My father died the previous year of Dylan. Okay. And it was just her and my father in a three bedroom house. So when my father died, it hit my mum really. It hit us all really, really hard, as we're such a close family, you know. I was actually there the morning my father passed away. I watched my father take his last breath. So it was, you know, my father had cancer, lung cancer, the fourth stage of lung cancer. So we knew our father, you know, he was on his way, you know, so we were there for him. And Dylan also helped out as well when
he knew his granny needed help.
He needed help. So when my dad passed, we had a roster going. Me and my five other siblings had a roster going to be there. Someone be there every night, because my mother was terrified. She didn't want to be in the house on her own.
I see. Yeah.
She was lonely. She was terrified. She needed company. She wanted company, you know. I was also a carer for my mother as well. And Dylan's seeing, not the stress, but, you know, as if any carers out there that are looking after their mother and father, they know it's not an easy job looking after your mother and father. And, you know, your children, as a child, you know, you feel like you have to give back to your mother and your father. You know, you look after them, they looked after you, they looked after your children.
And like you said, he's a similar personality to yourself. Childcare.
Yeah.
So he had this caring side.
He had that caring side. He said the caring side I had. He lived with his nanny from Monday to Friday. Looked after her, because it was very stressful. I brought my mother to all her appointments, hospital appointments, doctor's appointments, our women's club, and done our dinner every day. And, you know, he said, listen, Mam, he said, I'll go around and I'll stay with Nanny from Monday to Friday, because, we all have children, we all have jobs, you know, me and my brothers just have children, have jobs. He's listening, take the strain off everyone else. He said, I'll stay with Nanny from Monday to Friday and you sort out a roster for the weekend. I'll have my weekends to myself, he said.
He was
glad. He was around there. He had his own bedroom, his own TV, and he'd live with his nanny, who spoiled him wrong, you know. Who doesn't want to live with their nanny, you know?
But
he took on that role that most young men would not take on.
Exactly,
you know?
And they got on very well.
They got on great, you know.
Nobody he didn't get along with.
No.
It's just desperately sad. The 12th of November, 2023.
Yeah.
It's the last time you see him alive. Where is he going that night?
That night, I did not see Dylan the 11th of November, which was the Saturday. I didn't see Dylan that day because I was in work. And while I was in work, he actually stayed in his nanny's house on the Friday night. So he came around on the Saturday morning and I was in work. So while I was in work, he dropped into the house. When I came home from work, he was at leaving the house and going with friends. And I went to do food shopping and he came home while I was doing. We just crossed paths all that day, all that Saturday.
Very strange.
Very strange. And, you know, we see each other every day. We speak to each other. And just for some reason, that Saturday, we didn't cross paths and we didn't speak to each other. So the last memory I have of him is on the Friday evening, the 10th. So he came in after work, had his dinner, the usual standing over, ma'am, many more minutes for dinner, you know, standing there waiting patiently. I'd say, go inside, go into the sitting room, don't be standing over me watching me cooking, go in there, go into the sitting room, watch telly, and I'll call you when your dinner's ready. So he had his dinner, he had his shower, and of course, all his washing was there in the kitchen ready to be brought back around to Nanny's, and he got changed and he said, right, ma'am, I'm off now with my friends for more food. Dylan loved his food. He always loved trying out new places that opened up. Come on, we go here. Come on, we go there. It's only open now. He loved his chicken burger, chicken wings. Loved trying new places that only opened up.
That's what his plan was.
The weekend. Just food and out enjoying himself with friends.
Where are you when that call comes through?
I was in bed and I think it was around 12:40,
right,
that early that morning. And
who's on the phone?
His friend Jordan, who lives with us at the minute. We have Jordan now 6 years, and he was Dylan's close friend from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And he rang the phone and he was absolutely distraught on the phone. I couldn't understand. He was like, Dylan, all I could say is, Dylan is dead. And I said, John, hang on, what? Slow down, I said. Now, start again. What did you say about my Dylan, I said. And he said, Catherine, he said, Dylan is after being in a car crash. He's dead. And I screamed. I said, no, not my Dylan. You have it wrong. I said, that is not him. You have that wrong. And he just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed on the phone. So I rang his father, Paul, and I said, Paul, are you after hearing this? And he said, Catherine, I'm after getting a phone call, he said, but I'm after hearing he's gone to hospital. There was just so much confusion.
Yeah.
You know, we got no phone calls off any of the guards or anything.
It had just happened.
It just happened. And we got the phone call and I rang Dylan's dad and he was like, no, he's gone to hospital. I just did not know what to do. I was in a state of panic and I rang 999. I said, I'm at our hearing. I said, my son is after being in a car crash. Is there any information you can give me? And they said, you know, where did this car crash happen? I said, apparently outside the Red Cow. So they gave me the number of Clondalkin Guard Station to ring. I rang and they said, no, we have no information here about a car crash outside the Red Cow. So I just headed towards the Red Cow. My friend Rolf headed towards the Red Cow. And, you know, there was plenty of phone calls made on the way to the Red Cow. I've never been to the Red Cow before in my life. Plenty of phone calls made on that journey there. And there was a lot of confusion. No, he's grand. He's in hospital and it's this person and that, you know. And I prayed. Do you have it wrong? Do you have it wrong? He's in hospital. It's somebody else. It's somebody else that's after dying. And you just never expect that phone call. And as I drove, as I was getting driven there, I just seen the flashing lights and I said, stop the car, and the car was still going. And I jumped out of that car. I ran across the motorway, across the Lewis tracks and the barriers there, and I jumped over them barriers. How I did, I don't know. You just get this, I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I jumped him. I fell straight on my back. I bruised and cut my back and my face. And I ran and I said, my son, Dylan, I said, I'm after getting a phone call to say my son is dead. Tell me it's not true. I said, tell me my son is not dead. You know, I was met by this big, tall guard. And he looked at me, said, there'd be somebody to speak to. And I pray, I put my two hands together and I said, I beg you, please tell me it's not my son. He's a good boy. I said, he's a good boy. He's only 21. I said, please tell me it's not him. And he just looked at me. He said, there'll be somebody to speak to you in a few minutes. And I knew by the look in his eyes that it was my son. I knew. And I shook from head to toe. And I just kept saying, please. I just kept putting my hands in the prayer and putting it up into his face. And I'm sure that guard was like, you know, he was just, you know, I didn't know what was going on in his head, but I'm sure he just, that was the last thing he wanted me, was as a mother pleading and begging into his face that it was not my son that was dead on that ground.
And you'd known at this stage that there's been a crash.
Did
you know it was a hit and run?
No.
The guard, he did his best, and
he couldn't say anything.
You getting there as well, didn't he?
I said, I just want to see my son. He said, I can't. I was actually past, you know, the red tape. I was at, because I seen the lights, and I was actually, you know, I jumped out in front of the red tape, and I was only feet away from my son, and the guard came rushing up and said, I can't let you go any further. He said, there'll be somebody to speak to you very soon.
As things calm a little bit at the scene, do you have to identify Dylan there?
I didn't have to identify him. The guard came and she said, listen, there has been a road crash. It has been a hit and run, and we need you. You can identify your son if you like, she said. You don't have to, but I recommend you do, because in most cases like this, parents are just in disbelief. You know, if they don't see it for themselves, they'll never believe it.
Yeah.
So I said, of course I'll identify my son. I said, he's my son. Of course I will. I said, well, what type of mother would I be? You know, it's like some mothers, you know, and nothing against them or anything. If they couldn't, they couldn't. But with me, there was no way I wasn't going to identify him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, just give me a few minutes for forensics, have a board with forensics, and we'll get it sorted for yourself and Paul. And I said to Paul, I said, Paul, I'll go. I said, I'll go. You don't have to go. I said, I'll go. Save mm-hmm. him the pain. I'll take it all on board. I'm his mother. I'll take everything. So he said, no, I'll go with you, Catherine. He said, I'll go with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the guard came back and she said, we're ready now for you to identify your son. And as I said in my victim impact statement, it was like the road was miles long. You know, it was only feet away from us, and there was a white tent around him. And I'm holding Paul and I'm shaking my head. So please let it not be him. Please let it not be my son Dylan. Not my boy. He's a good boy. That's all he has. He was a good boy. He was a great kid. And when we turned the tent, the white tent, and to see my son laying on the ground on his own, a white sheet up to his chest, and blood pouring from his head. We were only allowed to stand so many feet away from him because forensics were still there doing their job. And I said to the guard, I said, can I touch him? I said, can I hold his hand? I said, so the guard looked at the forensics, and forensics shook their head and said no. And I said, please, I said, just let me feel his face. Just let me touch his face. I said, please. And he said, can't, you know, just they're still doing their job. The forensics are still doing their job. So I had to take it the way it was given to me. So I said, right, you know, I want this person to be done. This person that killed my son, I want him to be done. So I left forensics there. I didn't play and beg anymore with them. I left them there to do their job.
That was the protocol. Your priority, obviously, were your other young kids at home.
Yes.
And you really wanted to make sure they found out from you and not from anywhere else.
Yeah. My friend was at home. As I said, it was very late at night. One of the twins was in bed. Stuart twin was awake because she heard me screaming. And my friend rang, she said, Catherine, she said, the kids are here, they're, you know, I said, take the phones off them, take their two phones off, I said, because I did not know, you know, the way people are these days, they're quick to take their phones out and take videos of all this and pictures of all this before they even seek help for
it has happened.
Victims. Yeah. It has happened, yeah. And I've heard of it, yeah. You know, and I've seen.
And your kids are 14, you want them.
My kids are 14, and I wanted to protect them, and I said, take their phones off them straight away and tell them I'd be home soon. She said, Catherine, they're asking, you know, obviously they've heard somebody have texted them or somebody. I said, get the phones off them now, I said,
right.
And tell them I'd be home to explain everything to them soon.
The poor kids.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't know what was going on.
Do you remember much about the funeral?
It was horrendous. It was absolutely horrendous. My son came home. The next day after seeing my son dead, left like an animal on the road. The next time I seen him was in the funeral home where he was laid out. And when I went into the funeral home and seen him laid out, it was just disbelief. It just wasn't him. And I knew by looking at him in the coffin, his whole body was broken up. I knew. His neck was crooked in the coffin. His body was crooked in the coffin. They couldn't even cross his hands. You know, when you go to see someone laid out, they're laying out in the coffin and he had their hands crossed across their chest. They couldn't even cross his hands across his chest. And there's all cuts, all bruises on his hands. He had a big plaster on his forehead to hide the damages that was done to his head. His hair wasn't the way it always was. Dylan loved his hair. Dylan got his hair cut every second week. So his hair wasn't brushed the way he usually brushed it. So I fixed his hair all up and I just crumbled. We all just crumbled. We held. This cannot be happening. And the morning of his funeral, the house was packed. Outside the house was packed. Outside the church was packed with people, family, friends.
Coolock and Kilbarrack, everybody
Kilbarrack
came.
Everywhere. As I said, he played for many football teams.
Yeah.
His job, everywhere. And saying goodbye, you know, I just kept putting my head on his chest and just making sure before they put the lid on top of his coffin. I just wanted to make sure before he done that he really was. I can't explain. The only parents that have lost a child would probably be able to understand. You're just in disbelief. You just want it to be wrong. You just want them for their heart to start beating again, to come back to life. And I had to be dragged away from his coffin. We had him laid out in the living room. That's where Dylan's favourite place was. Relaxing after work, a hard day's work in the living room, watching TV. So we had him lay down in the living room at home. And, you know, I had to be dragged. And, you know, the funeral home, the lads from the funeral home and said, you know, listen, we have to leave this now, Catherine. You know, you need to go. You need to go and we need to get ready for Dylan's funeral service.
My heart goes out to you. I'm so, so sorry you had to go through all of this.
It's just, you know, we should never had to go through all this. Never.
We're going to come to the case. Do you want to take a little break?
No, I'm fine. I'm calm.
You sure?
Yeah.
Because the name Cameron Cooper becomes known to you.
Yeah, and I hate saying his name. I actually hate saying his name.
Just to make it clear to people, he had fled the scene on the night.
He did indeed.
He made a false report as a crime.
He did indeed.
That was a claim that the car was stolen.
He did.
How soon does he come forward?
He didn't present himself till few hours later, so which meant he could not be tested for drink or drugs in his system because he was too late. He presented himself too late to Gardaí.
Cameron Cooper, he had no previous record. He was driving the car uninsured.
Yeah,
it was travelling at 120 kilometres per hour
between 121 and 125, which was stated in court.
And this is in a 60 kilometre zone.
Yeah,
how does Dylan end up, you know, being struck by Cameron Cooper's car itself? What's going on at that moment?
Well, they were being dropped off to the Buzz nightclub outside the Red Cow, and Dylan had left his jacket in the boot of the car. So Dylan got out of the boot of the car, got out of the car, and went to the boot to get his jacket out. And Cameron Cooper came speeding and smacked full speed, going between 121 miles an hour to 125. Straight into the back of my son,
while he was
killing
him,
almost instantly killing him. Now, we heard in court only on the day by the girl, the first aider that, you know, came to Dylan's aid, that he had a slight pulse, and that absolutely killed me. I did not know that this until the 24th of March. We were not told anything. We've been told nothing about Dylan's case. This only all came to a light on the 21st of March.
And a number of people at the scene rushed to his aid.
But to hear that my son had, I was told he died instantly. And then, but to hear in court on the day he was supposed to be sentenced that he still had a light pulse just absolutely tore me apart. You know, in my head, what was he thinking? You know, did he feel anything? You know, and, you know, everybody has heard the injuries that happened to my son. It was just absolutely, you know, it's just absolutely terrible.
Did he ever show any remorse in the days and the weeks after killing your son with his car?
No remorse at all.
When does he hand a letter in to the court, which is a letter of apology to you and the family?
A letter of apology was wanted to be presented to us on the day he was supposed to be sentenced, the 24th of March. Barrister came over and said he has a letter of apology. I said, well, I can tell him where to stick that letter of apology. I said, I do not want a letter of apology on the day of his sentencing just to save his own skin, to say, you know, to make things look good for himself in court.
And this is
I was never accepted and it never will be accepted.
This is last month.
This is like 24th of March, the day he was supposed to be sentenced. You know, the court went ahead and he tried to hand us a letter of an apology.
And there was nothing between November 2023?
Nothing whatsoever.
You never saw the letter, never saw any.
No, I don't want to see it either. No, I'll never accept it.
There was no trial because he pleaded guilty. Did that spare you anything at all?
No, it did not. It did not. I would have happily gone to trial. He didn't plead guilty until the 30th of January. He didn't plead guilty.
Of this year?
Of this year, yeah. He was presented with the book of evidence in November. So he could, when he was presented with the book of evidence, he had no choice but to plead guilty. You have to plead guilty.
He had come forward, of course, on the night. It was several hours later.
Yeah.
He had come forward. So it was always likely to be the case.
Well, he told so many lies to guards. He rang the guards stating that the car was stolen. So he tried to give the guards the runaround.
He's been convicted
that night,
of that, yeah.
You know. And
in terms of the court date itself then, and in terms of sparing you any of the pain, you still had
but
to
we
sit
weren't
in court.
Spared,
yes,
yeah.
You had to hear his injuries.
We weren't spared any pain whatsoever. As I said, I'd gladly go to trial. If it meant him getting more years in prison, we weren't spared anything. We only walked into court on the 24th of March and heard the impact that crash had on my son. And I asked him to tell me, can you not tell me the impact it had on my son, and
the
he said no.
Injuries.
The physical injuries.
So you don't hear it until...
I didn't hear it till the 24th of March. We walked into court and I said, why can't you tell me now? I said, so I can scream and shout now, I said, before I go into this court and hear this. And they couldn't tell me. You know, we just got a blank wall. Every question we asked, it was... The only thing we were told is we can't tell you anything because we don't want to jeopardise the case. That's the only answer we ever got.
The judge then, in terms of sentencing, he sets a headline sentence of 7 years but takes into account an early guilty plea that reduced the sentence then to 5 years and 3 months, and then he suspended for the 12 months due to Cameron Cooper's youth and the prospect of rehabilitation. So that's a total of 4 years and 3 months. The reason you're here with us this morning, really, isn't it, is about how you feel about that sentence.
He was sentenced to 4 years, 3 months, but in prison... You only do 9 months of 12 months. If you're sentenced 12 months, you will only do 9 months of each year in prison. So realistically, he is only doing 3 years and 3 months.
And this is because prisoners are generally entitled to a quarter remission of their sentence for good behaviour, meaning they serve three quarters of the sentence.
He'd probably do 2 years and he'd probably be in an open prison for the last year. So the sentence does not match the crime.
The maximum sentence he could have faced was 10.
10.
It's different in the north of Ireland.
Northern Ireland is 14 years, yeah. But nobody ever gets it. Nobody ever gets to 10.
No, the headline.
Nobody ever gets it.
I think, and again, just...
And
going,
just to say, sure, like, yeah. the judges, they can use their full arm. Do you know what I mean? They can use the law and they can bring it, you know, they can...
Well, they're trying to they're trying to come to a sentence that won't be appealed and change too much in appeal, I think is what they generally try to do.
Yeah, that's what, you know, they're...
But they can only work within the legislation and sentencing.
The only, you know, they said, the judge said, you know, to save the family from going to trial. It didn't save us anything. You know, as I said, we heard all the injuries my son got. It only saved Cameron Cooper. It saved him a longer sentence and it saved the government a lot of money for not going to trial. But I would gladly have went to trial. I'm going to hurt for the rest of my life. I'm going to be damaged for the rest of my life. The things I heard in court that day, like what more could I have heard that day in a trial? There's no more. The only more I could hear was on Cameron Cooper's side of what he done wrong.
that's the main compelling reason, isn't it? And it's the most compelling reason, I think, for your campaign as a family is the extraordinary impact this has had on you.
Yeah.
You've had very serious mental health issues that you spelled out in your in your statement.
I've more than once tried to take my own life because in my head, you know, my son, he was me pride and joy, all my children are. And only grieving parents will understand where I'm coming from.
I have love for all my children,
but in my head, as I said, grieving parents will only understand is in my head, I want to see my son. I want to know where he is. Is he been like, I know he's gone, he's passed, but in my head, he's somewhere out there in the universe. Is he on his own? He needs his mammy. His mammy needs a son. Needs her son. I need him. He needs his, in my head, he needs his mammy. A child, it doesn't matter what age you are, you always need your mammy and your daddy. You always do. And I just want to know, I just want to be with him. I just want to mind him. I just want to be there for him. But I have other children as well to think of. And, you know, my mental health is just, it's so bad. I'm on antidepressants. I'm on anti-anxiety tablets. As I said, when I heard my son died, I shook from head to toe for weeks. I have a constant tremor in my right arm. My right arm never stops shaking. I'm on medication for that. I'm actually on four different types of medication every day.
Are you getting counselling? Are you getting help for the mental health issues?
As I said, grieving parents will only understand this as well. True counselling, that it's admitting that your son is gone, is passed, is dead. And, you know, I have got counsel. I've had a few counselling sessions and, you know, I need serious counselling sessions, to be honest with you. And I'm just not in that place to admit to my son is gone, you know.
Stages of grief are still extremely raw.
Yeah.
You also have this enormous fear for your other children.
For my other children, every time they go out, my heart skips a beat to say, "Mam, I'm going now. Where are you going? I'm going to such a place. Who are you going with? I'm with such a person."
These are natural fears, aren't they?
These are natural fears that every parent has. But when you lose a child, it's an extra fear. You do not know. My child walked out my front door and he never walked back in. And this is the fear I have of my other children walking out that front door and not coming back through it. That is the fear I have. And that fear is never going to leave me. Never.
This is the impact on you.
This is the impact. And it's never going to leave me. And it's never going to leave his dad either. It's never going to leave any of my family. His uncles, his aunts. Never. We're all so close. You know, it's just destroyed. It has upended our family.
Your relationship with your mother has been affected as well.
It's been affected, yeah. My heart just breaks every time I look at my mother because she's there. She's on her own. She's alone. She had a little bit of safety. She had a little bit of comfort with Dylan. And she idolised him. She idolised all our grandchildren. But she just for him, just to stand up and just to be there for her, to keep her company and to make her feel safe in her own home of 45 years.
She's been destroyed as well.
She's been destroyed as well.
You said you can barely drive.
No, I don't. I hate driving. I drive to A to B. And I only got a new car in October, 4 weeks before Dylan passed. And I used to love driving. When in a busy household, you know, you get busy. And my bit of therapy was going out into my car, driving, hiring up the music, going for a drive along the coast, and I come back a new woman, a new mother, you know, in a busy household before Dylan passed. But now I hate the car I've got. I hate driving. I drive, and when I stop in traffic, all I can see is my son, the vision of my son wedged between my car and the car in front of me when I'm stopped in traffic.
My God.
And I just hate driving now. I hate it.
Incredibly, Catherine, you've gone back to work here and there, haven't you?
I'm in and out of work all the time, in and out of work. And I'm just so lucky to have such an understanding boss who was also a family friend, who was also very good friends with my father. And if I had been any other job I was in, I'd been let go.
Dylan's father, Paul, and they were great friends.
Yeah,
he nearly died from the stress of this.
Paul, about 3 weeks after Dylan was killed, Paul was, he had an abscess developed in that. He had a pain in his back and he was told it was sciatica and he could barely walk. And I went up to his mother's house one day and I seen Paul there actually going around on his dad's walker. And I said, Paul, what is going on? He said, my back is on me. I said, get yourself up to hospital now, I said. I said, look at you. And, you know, Paul is very stubborn. You know, like most men, they're stubborn. They don't like doctors. They don't like going to hospitals. I said, get up there. I'll sit with you, I said, until you're seen to. He's like, oh, it'll be hours up and that. You're going to the hospital, said, and that's it.
It was sepsis.
It was sepsis. He had
from the stress.
From the stress. That brought it all on.
That's
grief and stress brought it all on.
But thankfully
and
he recovered.
He recovered. He went to the hospital and the doctor said, if you had left that for two more days, that sepsis would have killed you. And when I heard them words, I just crumbled all. I was straight up to the hospital. And, you know, Paul wouldn't let us to the kids, you know, they were really worried that Dad was in hospital. He was in hospital for weeks. The fear was just unbearable that we could not also did they lose their brother. Their brother was killed, that they could also lose their father as well.
Absolutely terrible. Your brother, Harry, as well. He's been working this campaign.
He has been just a godsend, my brother, Harry. He has educated himself in the law of this way. He shouldn't have.
He's a big part of this campaign.
He is a big part of this campaign and we would be truly and utterly lost. And I just appreciate him so much.
And just to make it clear, it's the call really on the Director of Public Prosecutions to appeal the leniency of the sentence.
Yeah, it does not match. It does not match the crime. The sentence does not match the crime.
Yeah, 4 years and 3 months is the sentence.
Yeah, this could happen to anyone. It doesn't matter how much money in the world you have or how much power in the world you have. This could come knocking at your door. This could be a phone call you could get. It doesn't matter who you are in this country or any country. This could happen to you. And I never in a million years did I think this was ever going to happen to me. This doesn't happen. This happens to other people. You know, never in a million years did I think this was ever going to happen to me. And never in a million years did I think my son would have been going down in a grave after my father died. None of the family did.
It's desperately sad, Catherine. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. You bore your grief with extraordinary dignity. And I know it's a sacrifice to be here, but it will surely do some good too, I hope.
Yeah, we will be appealing the case and I will scream and I will shout until I'm hurt and I will get that appeal. I will get that. I will make it my business.
You've put us in no doubt.
Yeah, I will.
But Catherine Killalee, thank you so much for coming in. Good luck to you and to Paul Maher.
Thank you,
Dylan's dad, and to the rest of your family as well. I hope they find a way through. Coolock is certainly behind you.
That's what I said. Like in Coolock, you know, when one falls, we all fall. And by God, we felt it. And just the amount of support that we got from Coolock when Dylan passed was just unbelievable. Unbelievable support we got. You know, as I said, we don't have a great name in Coolock, but the mention of Dylan's funeral, there's a rough in everywhere. So amongst the rough, there's always a diamond. And Dylan was one of them diamonds amongst the rough.
To anyone out there affected by our conversation today, rt.ie/helplines has all the supports available. Catherine Killalee, good luck and thank you.
Thank you very much, Oliver, for having me.
Well, there you go. An absolutely incredible portrait of grief. Thanks again to Catherine Killalee and her family as well. An extraordinary woman. A very, very difficult story to tell. And the pain after a year and 4 months, it's only been since she lost Dylan, still completely there. But she is speaking out as part of that campaign on increasing the sentences for dangerous driving causing death. And of course, you know, the DPP does not comment on individual cases, but the family are hoping the office will consider appealing the sentence, seek a longer one, given the appalling crime, the appalling pain the crime has caused to those people and the need to deter others from getting into a car and driving dangerously. And we know Catherine would also like to say a thank you to Susan Gray of Park Road Safety Group, who's been a huge supporter of the Killalees and the Maars since young Dylan's death. Park is an organisation set up by Susan Gray in 2006 when she lost her 51-year-old husband, Stephen. It was in a crash in Donegal 20 years ago last Christmas. Park advocates for road safety and helps those affected by serious road traffic collisions. Let's go to some of your messages now. Dear Oliver, please tell that beautiful woman, Catherine, how much my heart breaks for her. What a mother she is. I'm bawling in my kitchen. My mam was mowed down by a nameless drunk motorcyclist 44 years ago and the pain and damage to the next generation persists. All love and strength to Catherine. That's from Rachel. And we feel the pain for you as well, Rachel. What a beautiful woman. so eloquent, and she obviously reared a beautiful son similar to herself. That's from Moira. She says, RIP Dylan as well. Dylan was one of a kind. He was one of my best mates, and he was the nicest, most outgoing, happiest and funniest person you could ever come across. I miss him every day. We had the best of memories together, and those memories have been taken away because of a reckless fella who didn't even have the courage to stop and help Dylan after the crash. It just shows you the character of Cameron Cooper, and his sentence is a slap in the face to Dylan's family and friends. Another one. I've sobbed and cried for Dylan and Catherine and their family. I'm a mother of two boys who are 7 and 9. They are our world. I cannot imagine her pain. This country is a joke. The horrendous speeding on our roads has to stop. Can everyone just wake up and drive carefully? A life sentence should be given for this horrific loss of a young boy. A separate one. I'm commuting to work on the Dart now. Looking around, it's clear who's listening. Well dies everywhere hearing this brave mother. That's from Brian. I'm brokenhearted here listening about Dylan. Such a typical loving mother, an awful accident so raw in her mind. I'm in bits listening to it, so sad, from June in Galway. Utterly heartbreaking and tears listening, every mam's worst nightmare. Catherine has such a dignity in telling the story of her son's killing. I hope she's listened to. An ordinary, decent family just destroyed. Listening to Catherine on my way to work with tears running down my face. Her son Dylan sounded like a beautiful boy. He would be so proud of his mammy for speaking so openly about this. Thank you, Catherine, for speaking out. And hear, hear, says the rest of us. I think we'll take some music at this point. And that, of course, was the Beatles just before the ad break there. A song about healing, which I thought was appropriate in the circumstances. And by the way, Catherine is doing okay. She's tells us she's going off to talk to more media now, and she's going to campaign and talk and keep talking, and she is not going to stop. Where does she find the will and the strength, you do wonder? More of your messages now coming in. 51551. What a woman Catherine is. What a spokesperson for the injustice to her lovely son. I'm in tears here listening to her story. That's from Nell Walsh. Powerful interview. Hopefully this powerhouse of a mother will achieve justice for her beloved Dylan. Listening to the heartbreaking story this morning from Belgium. I had planned to switch off when I heard what the story was going to be, but I'm glad I didn't, even if I am in tears. Heartbreaking. What an amazing and brave mother with an important message. And that's with thanks from Irene, and thanks for holding on, Irene. I only hope that those who have influence to reform the laws on sentencing are listening to this interview. And there's a couple of messages here on the kind of the policy and the issues around the crime itself. Brendan says that young people don't understand risk. The answer is speed limiters on cars. They are compulsory in trucks. So why not in cars when they're driven by the young people? And that's from Brendan. I'm sure that lots of people say that it's not just an issue with young people, but speeding is certainly an issue with young men that we hear time and time again from the statisticians and the campaigners. On sentencing, and this is a general point about sentencing, not the crime that we're talking about this morning. The sentences handed down in this country are a disgrace, totally disrespect the victim and their families. Some in the UK who took someone's life was given a life sentence with a minimum term of 39 years this week. It doesn't happen here. Unfortunately, it is time to get tough. We have lost this country to criminality, and that's signed a very concerned senior citizen. Obviously talking about a different crime. We're not talking about murder. This is dangerous driving causing death. This message says it's a terrible tragedy, but speed and excessive speed is occurring now all over our country. It will not stop unless it is taken seriously, like drink driving. One day is a long time in prison. And the messenger says, I know as an acting prison officer that it's great to be able to leave the prison after 8 hours when the prisoners couldn't. Also, the culprit in this case will carry his crime for life. That's from John. That kind of touches on a subject which we talked about here last year, which is probation and early remission, where people get released. They're out unlicensed and it's not quite freedom. But obviously that is not, doesn't chime with the campaign that the Killaloes and Mars are looking for. This lady is amazing. My heart breaks listening to her. The leniency of the sentence is part of the problem. Hope she is successful in her campaign. And they're still coming in. I've just listened to your chat with the incredible woman, Catherine. My heart is broken hearing her story. The devastating last image of seeing your little boy lying alone on a road is just heartbreaking. He seemed like a lovely young man. No sentence will ever take away your pain. But I do hope the perpetrator receives more than the insulting sentence he received on the 21st of March. Our justice system is utterly broken. someone else says, an important interview. Can all of us who heard this interview make it our business to drive with care and consideration? There is no point in waiting for our legal system to make things better. And that is about the responsibility and care. It's actually something that Susan Gray, in her campaign, the Park organisation, talks quite a lot about. And this messenger, we leave with this one. She's getting the strength. Catherine Killey is getting the strength from Dylan. She's a wonderful example of a mother. That is true.